Hello, it's Monday, July 8th, 2024. I'm Arlene Ford, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Current and New York Times with me today is Lou Morando. Let's begin by taking a look at the photos on the front page of today's papers, and we'll start with the Hartford Current. There are four pictures on the front page of the Current. The first one is that of the entrance to Nathan Hale Ray Middle School in East Haddam. And the situation there is a young black eighth grader was allegedly harassed racially. And we'll be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. Then moving on, we have a photo. These two photos are related. We see a photo of a father and son. The father is Ray Owens, and his son is Langston Owens, and Langston is seven. They're on the Charter Oak Park basketball court located in Manchester, and they're practicing their basketball skills. And the photo under, the caption rather, under the photo reads, "Langston Owens, seven, works on dribbling drills with his dad, Ray Owens, as they spend quality time outside at Charter Oak Park in Manchester." Then the next photo is that of a sign on a telephone pole regarding a plant called hydrilla. And this is at Rock Landing in Haddam Neck. And apparently scientists are involved here because the hydrilla affects underwater vegetation, and we'll be doing a story on that later on in the broadcast. That's it for the photos on the front page of the Hartford Current. Let's now move to Lou Morando for photos on the front page of the New York Times.
Hello. Today we'll be reading from the New York Times Monday edition for July 8th, 2024. And the first big picture on that front page is that of aerial views of Elon Musk's SpaceX facility in Boca Chica, Texas. And it's a huge facility in the middle of a shoreline that is now being questioned as to its conservation philosophy, because there are people now saying that the he's damaging the wildlife and the surroundings of the land around his SpaceX facility. And that we first see an aerial view of the SpaceX facility itself with the launch pad for the largest rocket ever being made. And that is going to be, that fired off last month. And then below that, there's a picture of a Atlantic green turtle that has died on the beach. Then next to it is a great blue heron that's eating dead fish off the beach. And then there's a damaged snowy plover egg that they're finding on the beaches also. And it's obviously an environmental issue that is probably going to stay for a while until we find out if he is damaging permanently the environment. Then the next picture is that of an Israeli military transport with a group of soldiers and journalists inside the southern Gaza Strip. These transports are driving through total devastation of housing and buildings in South Gaza. And there will be a story on that. And then the last picture is from Mexico City. And what's happening in Mexico City is the influx of foreigners, particularly Americans, who find the dietary habits of the Mexicans being a little too spicy. And in particular, they're showing a dish that's being served at the Taquila Los Amigos, a 24-hour stand that sits in an intersection of Mexico City. And basically, there's too many complaints coming through by the people, or the travelers, that they have to get rid of the serrano peppers and just leave tomatoes, onions, and cilantro in the salsa. This is now what Mexico is saying, is that they're turning the meals into dressings rather than actual meals that are common to the Mexicans. So that's another national issue that will be brought forth about spiciness of Mexican food. That's it for the f- photos on the front page of the New York Times. Let's go back to Arlene now for the lead story on the Hartford Courant.
Putin keeping nuclear options open. The message to NATO from President Vladimir Putin was simple and stark. Don't go too far in providing military support for Ukraine, or you'll risk a conflict with Russia that could quickly turn nuclear. As the war in Ukraine turns slowly in Moscow's favor, Putin has declared that he doesn't need nuclear weapons to achieve his goals. But he also says it's wrong for the West to assume that Russia will never use them. It mustn't be treated in a light, superficial way, Putin said in June, reaffirming that Russia's nuclear doctrine calls for using atomic weapons if it perceives a threat to its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Moscow's nuclear messaging coming as NATO allies move to shore up exhausted and outgunned Ukrainian forces heralds what could become the most dangerous phase in the war. Moscow has carried out drills with its tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons in southern Russia and with ally Belarus, where some were deployed in 2023. The Kremlin described the exercise as a response to the West pondering the deployment of NATO troops to Ukraine and allowing Kiev to use longer-range weapons for limited strikes on Russian territory. Russian leadership may be assuming it has more at stake in Ukraine than NATO, and nuclear threats are one means of signaling its commitment to winning the war in the hopes of scaring off Western intervention, said Heather Williams, senior fellow at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. Ever since launching the February 24, 2022 invasion, Putin has repeatedly referred to Russia's nuclear might to discourage Western intervention. After early setbacks in Ukraine, Putin said Moscow was prepared to use all means to protect Russian territory, fueling fears that he could turn to tactical nuclear weapons to halt Kiev's advances. Putin later toned down his rhetoric after Ukraine's 2023 counteroffensive didn't achieve its goals. Amid Russia's recent military successes, Putin said Moscow doesn't need nuclear weapons to win in Ukraine. Simultaneously, however, he warned that Kiev's strikes on Russian soil with Western-supplied longer-range weapons would mark a major escalation because they would involve Western intelligence and military personnel, something the West denies. Representatives of NATO members, particularly in small countries of Europe, should be aware of what they are playing with, he said, adding they could be mistaken to rely on U.S. protection if Russia strikes them. The constant escalation could lead to grave consequences, he said. If those grave consequences come to Europe, how will the U.S. act in view of our parity in strategic weapons? Hard to say. Do they want a global conflict?
Biden courts key supporters as steps to step down persist. The article is by Nicholas Navanis, Robert Jimson, and Simon Levin. President Biden, in the midst of a political crisis in which his Democratic allies are asking him to be more unscripted in order to demonstrate his ability to do the job, instead did the opposite on Sunday, delivering brief remarks read from notes at a church to give an address that lasted roughly 7 minutes. At a worship service at one of the Philadelphia's biggest black churches, Mr. Biden, without a teleprompter, which he uses in most of his public addresses, sought to reassure a group of voters who helped him win the White House in 2020 that he is still capable of beating Donald Trump in the 2024 election. "The joy cometh in the morning," Mr. Biden told several hundred people at the Mount Airy Church of God in Christ, a visit that was become something of a rite for Democrats. "You've never given up. In my life and as your president, I've tried to walk by faith." Mr. Biden is at a tension point in his campaign, with his advisors seeking to keep his appearances tight and other Democratic allies wanting him to be more freewheeling to show he can respond to real time and to events. "You don't need scripted remarks," said Steve Sisolak, the former Democratic governor of Nevada. "He needs to show people that he can do it on the spot and answer questions, tough questions, and be out there with voters." The president did spend far more time meeting voters at the church and at two events later on Sunday than he has in recent weeks on the campaign trail. With his every movement and utterance under intense scrutiny, Mr. Biden avoided errors in his brief speech, but some Democrats are asking for far more than a gaffe-free morning, saying that Mr. Biden should give up his teleprompter completely and host primetime news conferences in voter town halls. Still, unscripted appearances come with risk, especially after Mr. Biden's disjointed 22-minute interview with ABC News failed to calm Democratic nerves. He also stumbled through two radio interviews, even though Biden campaign aides had provided the hosts with the questions, a breach of journalistic ethics that led one of the hosts to leave her station. During his career, the president has frequently turned to Black faith communities, both to offer support during community tragedies and to seek it when he was struggling politically. Black voters make up a key segment of Mr. Biden's coalition, although polls show his enthusiasm for his candidacy has dipped. Still, there have been higher opinions of the president's performance than with other groups and are far less likely to think he could drop out, according to New York Times Siena College survey conducted after the debate. Let him know we're with him. Hallelujah, one woman shouted from the audience as Mr. Biden walked on stage and a choir sang. Stacia Parker, 57, a longtime member of the church, said she thanked Mr. Biden for giving $117,000 worth of her student loans. She said she found him coherent and compelling, both on stage and up close in person. "We don't kick you when you're down," Ms. Parker said, showing off a selfie that the president snapped on her phone with her 7-year-old granddaughter.
French leftist bloc on track for upset. This is out of Paris. A coalition of the French left that quickly banded together to beat a surging far right in legislative elections won the most seats in parliament, but not a majority. According to polling projections Sunday, a stunning outcome that threatens to plunge the country into political and economic turmoil. The projections put President Emmanuel Macron's centrist alliance in second, no longer in control of parliament, and the bruised far right in third. With no bloc securing a clear majority, France faces uncertainty that could rattle markets and its economy, the European Union's second largest, and cast a shadow of political instability over the Olympics opening in less than 3 weeks. Final results are not expected until late Sunday or early Monday in the highly volatile snap election that redrew the political map of France even before votes were cast, galvanizing parties on the left to put differences aside and join together when Macron announced 4 weeks ago that he was dissolving parliament and calling the election, a huge gamble that he hoped would shore up his centrist alliance. It does not appear to have paid off for the deeply unpopular president. Projections forecast that his alliance would no longer be the largest single group in parliament, possibly by a long way. The National Rally Party of Marine Le Pen greatly increased the number of seats it holds, but fell far short of its hopes of securing an absolute majority that would have given France its first far-right government since World War II. In Paris's Stalingrad Square, supporters on the left cheered and applauded as projections showing the alliance ahead flashed up on a giant screen. Cries of joy also rang out in Republic Plaza in eastern Paris, with people spontaneously hugging strangers and several minutes of nonstop applause after the projections landed. Jordan Bardella, Le Pen's 28-year-old protege, who'd been hoping to become prime minister, ruled that the outcome of the vote throws France into the arms of the extreme left. The most prominent of the leftist coalition's leaders, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, urged Macron to invite the new Popular Front coalition to form a government. The alliance, he said, is ready to govern. The projections, if confirmed by official counts, will spell intense uncertainty for a pillar of the European Union, with no clarity about who might become prime minister and the prospect that Macron will be forced to govern alongside someone opposed to most of his domestic policies.
Israel protests seek ceasefire and an election by Isabel Kirshner. Israelis on Sunday marked 9 months since the devastating Hamas-led attack on October 7th and the start of the ensuing war in Gaza, with Another day of anti-government protests at a time that many here view as a pivotal junction in the conflict, primarily calling for a ceasefire deal with Hamas that would be seeing the hostages return from activity and for new elections in Israel. Protesters brought traffic to a standstill at several major intersections in cities and highways across the country. Much of the central Tel Aviv was blocked in one of the biggest protests in months. Some progress has been made in recent days for a resumption of negotiations toward a tentative deal after weeks of impasse, even as this fighting continues in Gaza, where the Israeli strike hit in the area of the UN school on Saturday and across Israel's northern border with Lebanon. But many Israelis, among them the families of some hostages, fear that the ceasefire efforts could be torpedoed not only by Hamas, but also by Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, who they say might prioritize the survival of his government over a deal that could topple it. The talks are based on a three-stage framework first publicized by President Biden in late May and later endorsed by the UN Security Council. Both sides agree on the broad outlines of the deal that could include an initial six-week ceasefire and the release of most vulnerable civilian hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. But Hamas is seeking reassurances that Israel won't restart the war after some hostages come home. Israel says it needs the option of resuming hostilities and will not effectively commit to a permanent ceasefire from the onset. Mr. Netanyahu's office issued a statement on Sunday evening saying the prime minister remains steadfastly committed to uphold the principles already agreed upon by Israel and endorsed by Mr. Biden, including that any deal must allow Israel to resume fighting until it has achieved all of its war goals.
Starmer aims to fix botched trade deal with EU. And this is out of London. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is seeking to reset relations at home and abroad. During a visit Sunday to Edinburgh that he billed as an immediate reset with the regional governments of Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales, Starmer said he would also seek to improve the UK's botched trade deal with the European Union. I do think that we can get a much better deal than the botched deal that then Prime Minister Boris Johnson saddled the UK with, he said in reference to the pact negotiated after Brexit. Starmer said there were many discussions ahead to strengthen trading, research, and defense ties with the EU, but he said those talks had begun as his top diplomat made his first visit abroad to Germany, Poland, and Sweden. With two of Starmer's ministers in Europe ahead of a NATO meeting this week, he made a point of visiting the leaders of the regional governments in the UK following his party's landslide victory last week. Starmer, who said he has a mandate to do politics differently, met with Scottish First Minister John Swinney in an effort to turn disagreement into cooperation. While each of the developed nations in the UK elects members to the House of Commons in London, they also have their own regional parliaments. Starmer's Labour Party trounced Swinney's Scottish National Party for seats in Parliament. But the SNP, which has pushed for Scottish independence, still holds a majority at Holyrood, the Scottish Parliament. Swinney said after meeting the Prime Minister that he believed there's an opportunity to work together to make a difference for the Scottish people. It is now 19 minutes after the hour. Front pages for July 8th, 2024 will return after the weather forecasts.